I'm Michael Silverblatt. More than 30 years of Bookworm shows are available at the Bookworm Archive on kcrw.com/bookworm. Today, we are repeating my 2006 conversation with Sadie Smith about her novel On Beauty. The show is one of the most requested shows from the archive. We discuss the art of fiction, the art of writing, and the art of reading.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm very pleased to have as my guest Sadie Smith, whose third novel, On Beauty, has been published in paperback by Penguin. She's the author as well of White Teeth and The Autograph Man. Now, I'm fascinated by this book, actually, and you've said that you used it as the occasion to teach yourself to write an English novel. What does that mean?
I think I used it as the occasion to finish writing a certain kind of English novel. There's something about my childhood and my education that when I started writing, I really wanted to prove I could do something pretty traditional, I suppose. And when I think of contemporary American writers, my peers, their instincts were all the other way. They would want to do something unusual and outside of their tradition. But I wanted to prove, I suppose, that I could walk before I could run. And this book to me was like paying a tribute to the gods, or at least a tribute to the writers that have sat on my head for 15 years, and I really wanted to escape from under their influence, but to write the kind of book that when I was a child I read and I suppose dreamt of producing.
It takes, to my mind, a very radical position, which is that none of its characters can express themselves honestly, and that in the course of the book, some of them will perhaps learn, or better still, learn not to attempt to say who they are with security.
Exactly. That's the thing. It's not that they can't express themselves well, but it's that the thing they've been told is self-expression is a mistake. So to me, particularly, someone like Levi, so a kind of young black kid in the book who feels himself to be in some way inauthentic or not as black as he should be, you know, those kind of arguments, that sometimes they're serious to the black community, and you hear them discussing them and arguing about them. And when I was a child, I was constantly being told that various habits of mine, I suppose including reading, made me less black than I should be. But, you know, the idea that you can be less authentic than you are is a nonsense. There's no such thing. And to struggle under that idea, to concern yourself constantly about your identity, seems to me a kind of prison. And it's one that white people don't have to anything like the same degree. They have a kind of existential freedom that they don't even notice, because, of course, it's what every human being should have and deserves to have and is natural. But if you don't have it, if you're constantly wondering instead not what it is to be, but what it is to be black, then you're completely cornered. So I suppose all my characters to some extent are looking for identities, and constantly when I'm in an interview I'm being told, your book's all about the search for identity, and I always think my book's all about that search being entirely pointless.
Well, stopping the search for identity, it seems to be, and the consequent hypocrisies and lying that go into the forging of a make-believe identity that will function in the world. And that's why it seemed to me that the book ends in a kind of silence, as beauty, which seems to be past articulation, is shown on a screen. It's a Rembrandt, and a husband by now, one wishes, silenced by a sense of his own lying inadequacies, but instead late and having left his folder, his lecture notes behind. But at least he is looking at the paint that represents Rembrandt's wife, who's in the ocean bathing, and who is in the depths, as his own wife, Kiki, has been throughout this novel. She seems to be, you know, a character who has been, even if not willingly, submerged and dealing with unimaginable difficulties and resisting definition.
Well, it's in our nature, in our culture, to cover things with language. And I don't, you know, there's an opposite sin you can make, which is the romanticization of things which are without language or of aporia or silence. And I don't mean to do that, but I'm a bit of an old-fashioned existentialist, and at the same time, I'm a bit of a Platonist. And it does seem to me that there are ideas, beauty is one of them, the good is another, which are in some way qualities that can't be articulated. I can obviously show you a series of beautiful things, but I can't describe to you in any rational way the idea of beauty, the thing extracted from all content. And then there is an argument that there's no such thing as beauty outside of beautiful people, beautiful trees. And yet, I continue to have an idea of it, and so do you, and I continue to have an idea much more radically of the good, not attached just to good actions or good people or good writing or whatever. So those things are real to me, but they're incredibly hard to articulate. But the fiction I love has people in it who are dealing with those ideas, and I want my characters to have the similar freedoms. I was amazed when I started being interviewed how much I misread it, that the idea that it's always a search for identity, and this is a positive thing, so that the best thing that could happen to them is they form some wonderful coherent identity and run into the sunset with it. But to me, that's horrific.
But haven't you noticed exactly that almost all novels are misread, that one of the things that happens if you are a reader more than you are a critic, as I hope I am, that you're watching books being handed to the culture that are trying to tell the culture something about itself, and the culture in return simply says what it already knows how to say.
Yes.
We're looking for identity. And
yes.
Instead,
or it's about gender.
It's about gender. And instead we just hope that on some unconscious level the watching of a transaction in time and space amongst people who have become familiar and moving to us will have an effect beyond the things that people know how to say.
Well, I think that's true, but I've been writing a lecture these past few weeks, which I have to give soon in New York, which is about exactly this, about what good reading involves. And I think your idea, the kind of hope that some subconscious level these things will pass through fiction, it isn't quite enough. I think of reading as a skill and an art. And if you read badly, like I always think, a good example, I've been trying to write this essay on Foster Wallace, and when you first read Foster Wallace or when critics read him, they give him back the thing that they think they see, which is some smart aleck with smart language, and with no idea
of what he's trying to determine what truth is.
Exactly.
What can be said truly.
Exactly. An incredible ethicist and
yes.
Seriously moral writer, but there's this kind of superficial layer of him, which if you can't be bothered to think any deeper, it just seems here's some wise guy with his wise-ass stories. And that's not true. But the problem with readers, the idea we're given of reading is that the model of a reader is the person watching a film, watching television. So the greatest principle is that I should sit here and I should be entertained. And the more classical model, which can be completely taken away, is the idea of a reader as an amateur musician. So an amateur musician sits at a piano, has a piece of music, which is the work made by somebody they don't know, who they probably couldn't comprehend entirely, and they have to use their skills to play this piece of music. The greater the skill, the greater the gift that you give the artist and that the artist gives you. That's an incredibly unfashionable idea of reading. And yet when you practice reading and you work at a text, it can only give you what you put into it. It's an old moral, but it's completely true.
Well, I think we couldn't be talking about anything more important, actually. I think that especially now, this was once known, that the reading of novels and poetry was instruction in how to be human.
Yeah. Well, this is there's this great, Aristotle called it education of the emotions. That is, dealing with texts which aren't moral philosophy, which aren't in a rational form, which aren't math. The material of the human, the material of narrative, basically. It's become so extraordinarily unfashionable. And when I When I try and talk about it, I get accused of suggesting these very banal ideas, like only good men write good books, or you need to know a man's life to understand his fiction. It's nothing to do with that. But good reading is an analogy of good living, because it takes all kinds of sensitivities, commitments, beliefs, passivity, all kinds of different qualities to understand, when you pick up, say, Pride and Prejudice, what is going on in that book, not just on the superficial level of its plot and character, but what it believes, that book. And, I mean, Austin, she was kind of a, you know, she's like a bit of a rationalist positivist in this sense, because she really believed that there are rational people who move through the world making these great choices, they make them very carefully, and at the end is a happy ending. So that's not to everybody's taste, but it is a model for what fiction does. Her books are a kind of hypothetical ethical arena. You walk into them, you have all these choices in front of you, and the wonderful thing about them, of course, is that they're not life or death. They're not your choices. They're Elizabeth Bennet's choices. But you place yourself in this arena and you move through this carefully affiliated world of choice. Austin does it in a quite simple and beautiful way. Other writers do it in an incredibly complicated way. And the complexity of that is a real education of the emotions and the education of the heart. And it's very hard to get that education elsewhere. So a piece of moral philosophy, On Beauty, was half based on a book called On Beauty and Being Just, which is a small theoretical text. But the question is, a small theoretical text gives you an idea of beauty and makes an argument which you have to come to with your rational mind. And then a novel can make exactly the same case, but it does it in a different way. And those procedures are vital. They're really important to becoming a human being. Becoming a human being isn't just something which you get with your birth. It's an exercise, and it takes your whole life.
Now, in this book, there are two families who eventually find themselves under the auspices of what everyone in the book likes to call the hallowed halls of a university. And this creates immediate difficulty, these hallowed halls, because the families, neither of them have any of their progenitors, people who were born to occupy a liberal arts institution of great prominence.
Yeah.
And so they are, in different ways, flouting or obeying hallowed principles that they have not, in fact, earned or encountered. They're just nominally placed. And the result is great comedy. People want, I suppose, to assume that the conservative characters are bad and the liberal characters are good. But in fact, they're all fallible because they're trying to live up to an estate that is not theirs. And they're acting as if the laws and ideas that generate a university are in fact natural ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I often... When you start writing, you're constantly asked about politics and whether you're a political animal. And you get more and more ashamed to say, no, I'm not a political animal, which doesn't mean I'm not interested in ideas of how we should live. But it does mean that I don't believe political differences of the kind that we understand them in America and England, between a Republican and a Democrat, between a Tory and a Whig, are the most important differences in human life. I don't believe that. And it's very, very hard to say that, because the culture convinces you every day that this is the most significant difference between human behaviors. So when I was writing, I was trying to decide if somebody holds a certain kind of view, for instance, someone like Monty Kipps, is that truly offensive to me? Is it offensive down to my toes? Is it something that I genuinely believe in as a quality that people have? And I realized as I was writing that I don't really. And the whole concept of offense at another person's views, I feel entirely ambivalent about, and I don't know whether that's something wrong with my makeup, but to me, those things are the least significant elements of a person's personality.
I'm speaking with Zadie Smith about her novel On Beauty, published in paperback by Penguin. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW, and we'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
Today's show is a repeat of one of Bookworm's most popular shows.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Zadie Smith about her novel, On Beauty. Now, a lot has been made about the fact that this book has been modeled on Howard's End, and I interpreted this as being that Howard's End provided a shape for oppositions that was an efficient shape, and that one of the novelist's tasks is to figure out, as opposed, say, to White Teeth, which was rather sprawling, what an efficient shape for the confrontations and meanings to emerge in, and that that was the help of Foster to this book, structure.
I think it's absolutely true, but I think every single one of my books has needed scaffolding. I don't know whether that's because I'm young and still uncertain, or because fiction needs scaffolding. Then the question is afterwards, how well you hide it. But what's also true about setups, like with the Autograph Man, I was very concerned with like the patterns of Hebrew letters and Kabbalah, as crazy as it sounds now. But whenever you set up these structures, you realize after you've written the book that you could remove them. But it's no good knowing it after the fact. It's what you need to give the book form. And I suppose I do believe that form is meaningful. To me, it's the same as plot. These two things which seem so archaic and you know, like a wind-up toy, like this phrase Kafka used, like a Chinese box. You keep on asking yourself, what is the point of making this little elaborate Chinese box, which is totally artificial, in order to supposedly show natural and true things? What's the point of that? And yet, and there are writers who reject it entirely, avant-garde writers, experimentalist writers. But I suppose there's something about the purity of plot that is incredibly meaningful for me. And when you take it away, even though you ideologically and intellectually, you know that plots are childish and simple, but without them, there's nothing there. There's something so profound about the way they take you through. So Forster's particularly good at them. He also resists them all the time. You know, he's a kind of mystic, and he doesn't want to plod through these Jane Austen plots, so all kinds of insane things happen. People die suddenly, and you hear godly voices, and he's kind of straining at the bounds of the novel, even though it looks so traditional when you read it. But I suppose I must still believe in plot, because I'm still writing them.
Now, in the novel, there are conversations about poetry, implicitly the confrontation between improvised poetry and written poetry, and about painting, about Rembrandt, implicitly that the paintings move us versus the way in which they are made and decomposed into their elements, and music as well, Mozart's Requiem, which becomes a thing of parts versus a thing of life and death, which seemed to me to be what all these characters are facing, a kind of life lesson between learning ideologies and learning to live.
I think also all the arts you mention counter the idea that life is all about finding out who you are, which is a very popular idea at the moment, both in your country and mine, that the whole purpose of life is to pinpoint exactly what kind of a person you are. Whereas great art to me, if I read a great piece of fiction, what I'm being confronted with is exactly what is radically not me, and a consciousness of the world which is so far from my own, sometimes it's a shock. And reading extreme experimentalism, for instance, is the best example of being forced into a relation with the world that you never imagined. And it's humbling, it's decentering, which is another thing we don't like to happen to ourselves very often. And it forces you to recognize the big question of life for me and the big question of fiction, which is that do other people exist in the same way I do? So hard to believe that's true. You know, you think you're the star of your own movie, and then there's these other people who are extras.
Now, I've been noticing that you've been speaking a bit about Iris Murdoch recently. And it seems to me that for her, the creation of a moral system and the creation of a novel are two different activities that intersect at a certain point.
Yeah.
And that the novels are ways to complicate a moral system. That the moral system can be embodied in its Aristotelian precision and beauty, but humans ball it up somehow, and that the novel is a way of showing what happens when a fly gets into the ointment.
I think that's true. The thing about it is, she, instead of making the argument that, the positive argument that good books come from good people, which you can never get away with and will always be shot down, she took the inverse relation and said, when you're reading bad fiction, what is bad about it? It's that the right, something is self-deluded here. There's a rarefication of women, which means you haven't been able to see clearly what this woman is. You've seen instead a symbol. Those mistakes are the same mistakes we make in life, to be deluded, to tell yourself comforting fantasies, to tell yourself stories that make you feel good. Bad fiction makes those mistakes too. And all of that, that's why she said that art is an analogy of morals. It requires some of the same skills. It doesn't mean it's identical, but any writer, even though they may never make this argument because it's very hard to make and defend yourself from critics and academics who'll shoot you down, knows that to be a good writer, it's more than craft. What needs to be improved is not just craft, it's also yourself. And I don't mean in some simple kind of American self-improvement sense, but you need to educate your consciousness and become like a delicate instrument. And when writers write bad books, it's not just a act separate from themselves. It's the writer who has written a bad book. When I write badly, it's because I've been cowardly, I've lied. It seems odd to say in fiction I've lied, but any writer knows what I'm talking about. I can reread a book, like I reread The Autograph Man on a plane for the first time a few days ago, and I was enjoying it to a point that I got to a 20-page section and I knew it was a lie, and I remembered when I wrote it, I knew it was a lie. That's what I mean. It's very, very hard to discuss as a critic or as an academic, but writers know what I'm talking about, and it's one of the most profound feelings of self-betrayal. You've betrayed yourself in some way.
Now, my final question is very much, I think, at the heart of On Beauty. If it, like Howard's End, had a motto or a watch cry, as Howard's End has famously, Only Connect. You can do the full version of Only Connect.
Oh, he said, only connect the prose and the passion and both will be exalted. And I've always taken it to mean that there are parts of your life which aren't purely intellectual, for instance, which aren't on this higher level, but they are connected to the other parts of you as well. And most of the misery of life, to me, is in feeling horrified by that other part of yourself. It's what makes Puritanism, for instance. You can't believe that you, this noble animal, also do terrible things like have sex and have perverse desires and actually want things which are against your own happiness, for example. But these things are true and human, and to be able to contain both ideas, it will make you happy, and rejecting this other half will cause disaster. And I think on Beauty, for me, I was thinking so much of class, and when someone like me becomes educated, you leave this other half of you behind, and it's incredibly painful. And it's hard to connect the me who likes to do the things I used to do and spoke the way I used to speak and was amongst the people I used to be among and the person I am now talking to you. And there's a great envy of the idea for me of a writer who comes from like a perfectly upper middle class family. He writes an incredibly complicated book. He takes it back to his family. They all read it. They love it. There's a unity there that's never broken. But for people like me, who are from a different class, as your life, if you educate yourself, as you become this other person, you've lost this other thing. And On Beauty is full of people terrified that they're becoming less of who they are by pursuing what's most meaningful to them. And I think Forster always knew, like with the Schlegel girls, they don't have to worry about that. They were born into education and soulfulness and an understanding of the world, and they'll remain there. But for Leonard Bast, if he comes and has tea with them and reads some of their books, and who's he going to be? He can't go home to his wife. He can't go home to his people. There's this radical division happens inside him. And that's what interests me, that he begins to feel like he's less authentic. He can't be the same guy.
The watchword I thought I found here was Mrs. Cripps's, what shelter we take in one another. And it had something to do, I thought, with the fact in this book there are many different houses and apartments and places to live and ways of living. But as soon as the generating presence is gone as soon as Kiki is out of her house, even the pears are rotting, you know. And as soon as the goddess is out of Mrs. Kipps's house, there's no house there. It's just a place of betrayals. And that we are stuck with one another.
Absolutely.
To make ourselves each other's house. And that to the extent that we can, we have to have an honest house.
But you make it sound like a pain, you know, it's a gift. It's not always easy to recognize, but to live through other people and with other people is the only point there is. That there really is nothing else. Well, not to me anyway, but it's hard to understand. That line is a line of my husband's from a poem of his, which I thought was so beautiful. It's true there's such a shelter in each other, but it's also true, there's a quote at the beginning of the book from a philosopher saying that we refuse to be each other. And that's true too. It's, you know, it's really impossible to make a leap of empathy entirely into another person's head. You try it in marriage, you try it with your lovers or with your children. And to do it entirely would be intolerable, of course, and would be a dissolution of yourself. But it has to be done to some extent. Otherwise, there's only strangers and enemies, people who are opposed to your will, and trying to understand that your will is not the only thing on the planet, but is has demands and makes space for all these other wills. That's the whole point.
I've been speaking with Zadie Smith, author of On Beauty, published by Penguin. Zadie, I want to thank you because I feel like we've really talked about
this. We had a good conversation.
Yes. And it's such a relief because, you know, as part of doing my job, I read a great deal and I always find myself thinking, no one's talking about the book I just read.
No, they talk around it.
They talk around it as if somehow or other something had happened to the join between intellect and heart that prevents even accuracy, let alone...
I think that's true, but, you know, sometimes great books are a shock. Mine is more comforting, but when I think of the writers that I really love right now who are doing radical work, it might take 10 or 15 years for you to notice
what they've written
about.
What
they meant and what was of worth in those fictions. For now, they have to put up with a lot of mistaking.
Today's show was first broadcast in 2006. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show. It's also available at Apple, Spotify, and other podcast services. I'm told it airs twice a week in Berlin. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Sean Sullivan, associate producer, Alan Howard, and technical director, Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just read this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Daphne Merkin is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.